Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello and welcome to the Books Podcast with me, Claire Armitstead. In this week's show, I'm talking to two authors who I greatly admire not only for their writing, but for the way they have plucked literary triumph from the jaws of journalistic adversity. Both were once newspaper hacks like me, you see, and I hope neither will mind me pointing out that they were both nudged towards books by the attritions of a shrinking newspaper industry, losing jobs in which they were happy and apparently very successful. Olivia Lang, one-time deputy literary editor of our sister paper, The Observer, is the author of three mould-breaking works of non-fiction. But not content with charting the length of the river in which Virginia Woolf drowned herself, or tracking the lives of literature's most famous alcoholics, or exploring the role of loneliness in creativity, she has now written one of the most distinctive novels of the year, a small and piquant work of auto-fiction. Crudo, one reviewer wrote, is a hot, hot book. Christina Patterson, one-time columnist for The Independent newspaper, has gone down a different route with her first book, The Art of Not Falling Apart. It's a smart improvisation on the theme of self-help literature, using her own somewhat disaster-strewn life as a stepping stone to resilience and wisdom. Welcome to both of you. Now, I'm going to start by asking each of you to explain your books, and then we'll open it up to a broader discussion, because different though these two might sound, I think there are lots of really intriguing similarities in your projects. Let's start with Olivia. And for such a slender volume, Crudo is really quite complicated to unravel, isn't it?
It is. There's a lot going on in it. It's a 7-week real-time account of the summer of 2017. And lots of it involves my life, but it's set from the perspective of a writer called Kathy, who bears all sorts of resemblances to the dead writer Kathy Acker. And it's about this person getting married, struggling with the demands of intimacy. But it's also about what it's like to live in the hyper-real, hyper-violent moment that we've suddenly found ourselves inhabiting.
So will you just read us the very opening paragraph? I think it's a single paragraph, just to give some indication of just what I'm talking about when I say it's complicated.
Kathy, by which I mean I, was getting married. Kathy, by which I mean I, had just got off a plane from New York. It was 7:45 on the 13th of May, 2017. She'd been upgraded to business. She was feeling fancy. She bought 2 bottles of duty-free champagne in orange boxes. That was the kind of person she was going to be from now on. Kathy was met at the airport by the man she was living with, soon to become the man she was going to marry, soon, presumably, to become the man she had married, and so on till death. In the car, the man told her that he had eaten dinner with the man she, Kathy, was sleeping with, along with a woman they both knew. They had also been drinking champagne, he told her. They laughed a lot. Kathy stopped speaking. This was the point at which her life took an abrupt turn, though in fact the man with whom she was sleeping would not break up with her for another 5 days on headed writing paper. He didn't think two writers should be together. Kathy had written several books, Great Expectations, Blood and Guts in High School. I expect you've heard of them. The man with whom she was sleeping had not written any books. Kathy was angry. I mean, I was angry. And then I got married.
So there's a provocation in the first three lines, because by 13th of May 2017, as you pointed out, Kathy Acker had been dead for 20 years. So just tell us who this Cathy Acker is and why you're so interested in her.
Cathy Acker is the most spectacular writer, and I worry that she's been remembered more, if for anything, for her appearance, which was very gripping from the off.
She wore a lot of punky,
Vivian Westwood, lots of piercings, lots of tattoos, shaved hair. And in a way, that's problematic because I think that sort of disguised how incredibly exciting, radical and of the moment her books are. They plagiarise wildly. They steal things like Don Quixote and Dickens. But they're very much addressed to a moment like ours. They're about abortion. They're about terrorism. They're about hyperviolence. And I find her such an exciting, interesting writer. And because she's such a spectacular thief, I thought perhaps I would just steal some of her biography and put it to my own ends.
So thievery is one of the themes of this book, isn't it?
Yeah, it's about stealing, but it's also about appropriating and reassembling. And I think we're in a cultural moment that's so much about an absence of stable identity, where there's an impossibility of having a solid individual self, that it seemed absurd to me to write a kind of book that gestures towards the realist novel. That doesn't feel like where we are. And what I was trying to get at was what it's like to inhabit the fractured moment that we're in, where you look on Twitter to see what your friends are doing and you experience global Holocaust, terrifying images of concentration camps.
But there's also the issue of how you can disappear into writing. And she can be anyone. On the page, the eye dissolves, becomes amorphous, proliferates wildly.
And that's so much an Acker thing. So whenever my character Cathy writes, they write from Cathy Acker's book. So I sat there going through like a magpie, stealing lines and being amazed at how appropriate they were for stories about Trump or stories about Brexit. And I was fascinated by the way that she does that, that she would just steal somebody else's book but put it into the first person. So I wanted to steal elements of my life but put it into the Cathy Acker person and see what happened, really. It felt like a fun game to play.
And it's also a meditation on biography, partly. So you say she was trying to remember the 1980s, particularly 1987. What did people know? What were they ignorant of? This was the problem with history. It was too easy to provide the furnishings but forget the attitudes, which is so interesting. So that's about how do you inhabit the past?
And this is actually a question that's been there in my books all along, from the Virginia Woolf one that I wrote first, is what's it actually like to be in the present moment? We always look back at things from the historical perspective. So we always think Virginia Woolf's life is tracking towards a suicide, and yet she's living constantly with her nose pressed up against the present moment, like we all do. And I was also so aware that that summer in particular was going to be historicised very quickly and was going to become a narrative where each event was followed sequentially by the next event. And that wasn't the experience of living it. So I was trying to write down everything every day and just see how it felt to inhabit that sort of terrifyingness. So at one point I talk about a small event in Spain that seems sort of slightly unsettling, but not a big deal. And obviously that became a constitutional crisis and a major deal. And yet there was a day where it was just a little blip in the news cycle. And whether those things emerge into something enormous or just drift away seemed like something important to try and record, to try and write down.
And one of the issues that comes up is gender. And I'm really interested in this because you place in Cathy's mind a sort of a refusal to have a stable gender identity. But that is also a current concern, isn't it? When you talk about the possibility of inhabiting the 1980s, I don't remember that being a possibility in the 1980s.
It's interesting because obviously there's all sorts of stuff about my own sense of gender in the character of Cathy, but also a lot of it is very closely drawn from Cathy Acker herself. And she's the one who said, when she had breast cancer, lop them both off, I don't care, I always wanted to be a boy. And that's something that I've felt too. So there are these moments where I can use her written record to say things about myself or vice versa. And obviously we're in a very different gender moment now. We're in a moment of gender fluidity, and that's becoming codified in a way that's very different from the 80s. But, you know, I grew up in a lesbian family in the 80s. I remember it rather differently to how people in maybe more conventional families did. So that sense of gender fluidity is what I grew up with as well, very much.
Okay, I'm now going to park Cathy Acker / Olivia Lang there, and I'm going to move now to Christina Patterson. Christina, as I said, The Art of Not Falling Apart, it sets itself up through that title as a self-help book, which is not really what it is.
No, it absolutely isn't. If anything, it's an anti-self-help book. Well, there was meant to be a kind of play on art, because obviously there isn't an art. I mean, there is no formula in Not Falling Apart. Life is an art. How we deal with what life throws at us is an art. And I was kind of playing on genre. So the book is what publishers helpfully call generically unstable, because it's essentially it's a kind of mix of memoir and interviews. And I suppose in another sense, you referred to the fact that I'm a journalist, and I was kind of wanting to draw on my particular journalistic skills and experience, which were writing columns, doing interviews. So in one sense, the book is a kind of mix of a column, a rather confessional column, and interspersed with lots of interviews, because what I've done is woven together my own experience over roughly 2 years, but with lots of retrospective stuff woven into it, with interviews with about 20 or 30 people in different situations in a three-part structure. So yes, it does sound like a self-help book, and helpfully lots of bookshops are sticking it in practically in the witchcraft section of their bookshop.
Yeah, it's like, I remember Shirley Williams is climbing the bookshelves, her memoir being stacked in the mountaineering section of a well-known bookshop.
I just had yet another email from someone, from a guy who said for the first time in his life he'd stayed up all night to read a book, which I was very flattered by. And then the next day he said, but I went into my local Waterstones and they didn't have it. And so I forced myself to do that thing which, you know, you never want to do, which is, you know, you kind of skulk into a Waterstones. And I skulked into a Waterstones, which had better remain nameless, past piles of books by people I know, piles of books I'd recently reviewed, couldn't find my book anywhere, you know, kind of crept up to the assistant and said, you know, do you have this book, which by the way is mine? And she said, she looked it up and she said, oh, we wouldn't stock a book like that. And I said, a book like what? And she said, self-development. And I thought, oh, I didn't know I'd written a book about self-development. So that was not one of the finer moments post-publication. But and I'm dying to read Olivia's book, really dying to read it. But part of this was absolutely about playing with genre. That was part of the idea of it, yeah.
Your persona, should we say, the you in this book, since we're talking about the artfulness of self-representation, is pretty damn accident prone. I mean, you have cancer, your father dies, your sister dies, you lose your job under horrible circumstances at just the wrong moment.
Yes.
is this a sort of ramping up
of
the horrors that
happened
to you?
I have to say that when we're talking about fictionalising, I have done no fictionalising of my life at all. From that point of view, I'm clearly a stolidly literal-minded person, because it's not a persona, it is absolutely me. And there's the odd interview where I have changed the odd detail, which I do say in the book, and a few names have been changed. But it is, although the genre is kind of playing with, you know, there is some art in the genre, and I hope some art in the writing and the form, factually, in terms of my life, it is absolutely accurate. And I mean, obviously it's my life, so it feels completely normal to me. But if it seems accident prone to someone else, then I just have to say I've had a rather accident prone life.
But it's not only your life, is it? The interviewees that you pick out have had really difficult times. I mean, one of whom is Frieda Hughes, who,
yes,
you know, who's the daughter of Ted Hughes and,
yes,
Sylvia Plath, could hardly have had a more traumatic childhood in some ways.
No, well, I mean, I was incredibly pleased that she agreed to talk to me. And there was a moment talking to her when I had goose flesh, actually, when she was telling me about how she actually remembered being in the car when Sylvia Plath had killed herself, and she was in the car with these two adults, and she didn't recognize her father, Ted Hughes. And she said for years she thought he wasn't her father. For years she thought she was adopted. And for me, that was a kind of, obviously a poetry buff and somebody who used to run the Poetry Society, a kind of incredible moment when you think, oh my goodness, I'm speaking to the daughter of one of the most famous poets of the 20th century, and she has just told me something I didn't know before. She certainly has had what you might call a very accident prone life. But, you know, all of the people in the book, nearly all of them, are people I know. Many of them are friends. Some of them I know extremely well. Some of them I came across and don't know all that well. But there are also some friends of my parents who lost not one son, but two. And so these are not, you know, I didn't go to some special institution for accident-prone people. You know, these are just people I've met in the course of my life. I think the fact is that everybody has clearly, you know, I mean, by definition, by being alive, we have problems that go, you know, we all have things that go wrong in our lives. I think as you get older, you clearly have more of them. And I do remember in my mid-20s when I was literally crippled with an autoimmune disease called lupus, as you are when you're 24 and, you know, everything. I remember meeting these people, and the worst thing that would have happened to them in their life would be that they got a 2-1 instead of a first, you know. And I remembered, you know, trying to, you know, smile and, you know, nod and thinking seriously. But we are into kind of hashtag first world problems territory here, aren't we? Because obviously, you know, on the one hand, those of us who live in this country are incredibly privileged, et cetera, et cetera. And on the other hand, we can all have enormous suffering. And the other thing is that our suffering, the depth of our pain, is not correlated to the events in our lives. So you can have, I had a very severe acne throughout my late teens and my early 20s. And I found that just as terrible as some of the other things that, you know, theoretically should have been worse, because I felt ugly and disgusting, as many people with acne do. And there are very high levels of people who are suicidal with acne, for example. So I think we make the mistake of thinking because you've had dramatic things go wrong in your life, your pain is worse.
Now, at the beginning, I set it up as a journey towards resilience. And it is. All these people that you interview have found some sort of way of dealing with what life has thrown at them. And in your case, you claim the power of anger. That's one thing. Mm. You love a glass of wine. Mm. You like parties. Mm. You don't like men much.
Oh, no, that's not true, Claire. I've learned to tolerate them. No.
You've just met a few bounders in your time.
Exactly. No, I don't. That's absolutely not true. I do like men. And nowadays, I would say I almost like men as much as I like women, which is, you know, quite a shift for me. I've met some in my time. I mean, you know, all of us have worked as journalists. And we all know that journalism is newspapers are very male-dominated trade. And there's a lot of testosterone, a lot of strutting around, a lot of diktat. And that, for me, was a little bit of a shock when I joined the paper. I worked at The Independent for 10 years. But I did enjoy it. And most of the people I worked with were absolutely lovely. And then in the last year or so, a few of them weren't. And obviously, they will remain nameless. But, you know, it's allegations, etc. But generally speaking, and I chose badly. On the romantic front, unfortunately, I had a tendency to be attracted to charming narcissists who, you know, didn't bear much relation to Mother Teresa. And that was a mistake. But there are lots of lovely blokes in the world. And I know lots of lovely blokes. And I enjoy the company of blokes. So it's absolutely not fair to say I don't like men.
Fair enough. Right. So now I'm going to bring Livia back in on that point, which is nothing to do with your attitude to lovely blokes, Olivia, I can assure you. It's on this issue of mixing genres. What do we call your novel? It's autofiction, biofiction.
I invented biofiction this morning.
Did you?
Yes.
I invented it this morning.
I was quite proud of that, because I thought it isn't really, it is autofiction, it is biofiction, it is fiction.
Fictobiography, perhaps.
It's not that fictionalised. I mean, it's a complex net of things, as all my books are. And I find the whole question, not your question personally, but the general question of what genre does this book fit into, so frustrating and tiresome that I feel like I write books that have elements of memoir, or they have elements of travel writing, or they have elements of biography and cultural criticism, and that is the book. And there's always some suggestion of, especially in reviews, oh, if only this was just a biography, I think it would be great. And somebody else saying, well, I wish it was a memoir. And that always feels like really missing the point, that the books that feel most interesting to me, most exciting to me, are the ones that do marry lots of different kinds of writing together.
And one of those writers is Chris Krause, who wrote a biography of Kathy Acker, which is one of your source, you cite as one of your source materials for this.
Yeah, and Chris Krause is such a good example with I Love Dick, which is the sort of, I know she doesn't like the word autofiction, but it is very much an autofiction, that it uses elements of her life. It turns it into a novelistic structure, but actually it contains, when you look at it again, and I'm always surprised when I go back to it, it contains so much about other artists. It contains so much about politics. There are huge sort of extended riffs about war and violence in Latin America that you absolutely forget are there, because you're sort of so bewitched by the story of her stalking poor old Dick. That sort of layering and mixing together makes a book feel alive to me in a way that reading a realist novel, or indeed a biography, I'd find quite frustrating.
In this week's Extra Books podcast, we're treating you to a reading by Bill Nighy of the Moomin short story The Invisible Child by Tove Jansson, in association with Oxfam. Here's a little extract.
The bell came tinkling downstairs, one step at a time, with a small pause between each step. Moomin Troll had waited for it all morning. But the silver bell wasn't the exciting thing. That was the paws. Ninny's paws were coming down the steps. They were very small, with anxiously bunched toes. Nothing else of Ninny was visible. It was very odd. Moomin Troll drew back behind the porcelain stove and stared bewitchedly at the paws that passed him on their way to the veranda. Now she served herself some tea. The cup was raised in the air and sank back again. She ate some bread and butter and marmalade. Then the cup and saucer drifted away to the kitchen, were washed and put away in the closet. You see, Ninny was a very orderly little child.
To hear the full story, go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Now, you wrote this novel quite quickly, didn't you? You didn't expect...
I wasn't writing a novel.
You didn't intend to...
No, I mean, I was writing a non-fiction book about violence and bodies, and I've been trying to write it for quite a long time, and I was aware that I was struggling, and part of why I was struggling was because... the news cycle was changing so fast, the conditions that I was trying to write about were changing so fast, that I felt like I couldn't find the stable point from which to report. That's something that I need in a book, is to sort of feel like I've got a grasp of the ground before I start surveying it. And I didn't. And so that sort of was building up a tension. And I was reading Chris Krause's book about Kathy Acker and reading again about how Kathy appropriated. And something about those two things sort of came together. And I started thinking, well, what if I just write down everything that's happening, but from this Kathy perspective, and see what happens? And immediately realised, OK, I've hit on a form that is allowing me to say what it feels like to live in this summer, which I don't know about you, but I spent it in anxiety, terror, despair, rage, fury, as well as dealing with the sort of new marriage intimacy problems that I was simultaneously experiencing. So it was a form that let me deal with both of those things. And I wasn't planning on publishing it, but I had two rules, which were that I had to write at least once a day and I wasn't allowed to edit or even read back. So this is basically completely... I mean, it has had a couple of legal reads and a few edits, but basically it's still incredibly raw, hence the title Crudo. And it is just a very loyal document to what those 7 weeks were like. And at the end, I finished it in Heathrow Airport and sent it to my agent and got on a flight thinking, well, that's that done. But I still wasn't thinking that it would become a book until...
It's so interesting because it seems so composed. It's sort of... I'm in awe.
It's not composed. It's very discombobulated. It's the record of a very discombobulated psyche.
And now, Christina is nodding furiously over there on that microphone. And you tell us a little bit about how you came to choose this particular form. I mean, I'm just very interested in why writers choose particular forms at particular times.
Yes. It's such a hard question to answer because since I left The Independent and editors have said to me, so how are you going to write this piece? And I've thought, sorry, I never, ever have planned structure of anything in advance. So things emerge. And when I wrote a column twice a week for years, and readers would say, oh, you know, you took me on a journey and I didn't know where we were going to end. And I thought, well, that's because I didn't know where we were going to end. And I do think writers work in different ways. Some, obviously, crime writers, generally speaking, I imagine, have to plot very carefully. That's not the way I work, though I did I did try to come up with a structure before for this, because when you go from writing maximum 4,000 word pieces to 100,000, obviously, you know, it helps to have a bit of planned structure. I suppose it really is a hard question to answer, because it was a kind of unconscious. I didn't just write it from scratch for 100,000 words and see where it went. But I didn't kind of consciously think, what's the structure going to be? I suppose I thought, this will start with my own voice and experience, and I will weave in and out of other people's stories. And that was partly a nervousness about memoir. I've been trying to write a memoir for years. I have, in fact, written a memoir, which I haven't shown to any publishers. And if I ever write that, it will be in a different form, and I'll probably have to rewrite it from scratch. And I have cannibalized little bits of it for this book. But it was partly a kind of sense that we are in such a solipsistic culture now that I feel nervous about writing a book that's all about me. And I don't want this book to be all about me. I want it to be layered with other people's lives. So this felt like a way to solve that problem, I suppose.
Is there an extent to which both of these books are like, they're provocations in a way, aren't they? Because we know that people always say, oh, it's women only write autobiographically, it's all domestic, it's minor.
I'm rolling my eyes wildly.
Yeah, exactly. But you're flirting with that, aren't you? You're daring anybody to say that of these books.
Yes, yes, I suppose so. Because it seems so, you're not allowed to use that territory at all in case somebody comes and criticises you because of your gender or because of how they assume your gender. I find that so frustrating and tedious. It seems incredibly exciting to me to be able to report on the ways in which personal life and political life intersect and to be able to use an eye in all sorts of different ways. It's such a flexible weapon, an eye. It doesn't have to be about the interior of the self in a narcissistic way. It can just be a set of eyes. It can just allow you to bring a reader in very close. But then on the other hand, it can be a way to talk about very private experience. So it seems like, why would you surrender this super useful tool just because there's a danger that you come across as a narcissistic woman? That seems ridiculous.
Yeah, another thing I've sort of felt I've encountered a little bit since leaving The Independent is editors who want you to, I'm happy to write personally as long as I'm the one who gets to control, you know, the kind of the tone and the shape of the piece. But this idea that if you're a woman over 45, then obviously you're a middle-aged woman who wants to write, you know, confessional pieces about how hard it is to catch a man or whatever else it might be. And one of the themes of my book is about being single for most of my adult life. And, you know, people have referred to Bridget Jones, and that's fine up to a point. I think Helen Fielding did a very important and interesting thing with Bridget Jones in acknowledging a phenomenon of our times, which is, among other things, the mismatch between educated, successful, high-achieving women and the challenge of finding, if you're looking for a male partner who is not intimidated by that, that's a perfectly acceptable thing. But, you know, personally, I'm not very interested in the domestic. You know, I've never lived with someone, apart from with, you know, flatmates when I was young. I hate cooking. I'm interested in, obviously I'm interested in lots of trivial stuff, but broadly I'm interested in politics and ideas. And I bitterly resented, as a journalist, being thrust into the kind of soft territory and suddenly feeling that you're not allowed to write politics anymore. I've really felt that very strongly in the last 5 years. My book doesn't touch on politics. I mean, I hope that my next book might in some way, if I get to write one and if someone will publish it, etc., etc., she says nervously. But I really, really, really resent that sense that as a woman, you have to do the domestic stuff. And, you know, even I've had a review in which I felt, in fact, it wasn't me, but a friend pointed out, she said, this person is reviewing your life, your lifestyle. And I thought, yes, actually, that seems to me the case in this particular review. And I reserve the right not to have my lifestyle reviewed. You know, we are writers. I don't even see, I mean, this sounds like a ridiculous thing to say in the age of Me Too, and possibly a naive thing to say, but I never really felt I looked at the world through a particularly gendered gaze, because I didn't have children, I didn't have a husband, I didn't, you know, I stayed late at the office every night because that's what it seemed to me it took to do the job. Obviously, I was intensely aware that if you looked at the women who were in high at relatively senior levels on my newspaper, funnily enough, they were nearly all single without children. Clearly, that is a major problem. But did I go around thinking, oh, I'm being really discriminated against here because I'm a woman? I absolutely didn't. I don't know. I just I think I'm a person. People have said, someone said to me the other day, this is a book for, you know, for people who read stylist. And I thought, really? A, I've never read stylist. For women who read stylist, I thought, A, I've never read stylist, but, you know, that sounds interesting enough. And B, it's not for women, it's for human beings. Why do we have to keep banging on about people's gender all the time? So that makes me cross, actually.
Yeah, and that what's interesting about these two books and why I had this brainwave of bringing you in together is actually they read brilliantly as a pair. they're doing very different things, but the intellectual project in some ways is similar.
Well, I'm absolutely dying to read yours now.
We'll have to do a quick exchange after this podcast, after we've left this podcast.
Exactly.
Well, thank you very much both for coming in. And all I can say is I would urge anyone to read both the novel and the non-fiction self-help not book. I was speaking with Olivia Lang and Christina Patterson. Crudo is published by Picador and The Art of Not Falling Apart is published by Atlantic Books. Both are out now. Next week, summer has definitely begun here in the United Kingdom, so it's time for our annual catch-up on what you should read, what they want you to read, and what you actually are reading. Notepads at the ready, we'll have all the best books to accompany you on your holidays. And do please subscribe and review us on your favourite podcatchers. Join the discussion on Twitter or by leaving a comment on the podcast page at theguardian.com/bookspodcast. As always, if you prefer to contact us directly, you can email us at bookspodcast@theguardian.com. But for now, from me, Claire Armistead, and my producer, Susanna Trezillian, thanks for listening and goodbye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.